Hi, everyone. This is a small crowd, so welcome to the Fulbright, How the First Social Network Adapts to Social Media session. And we're going to be talking about Fulbright, the Fulbright program, and programs like it, and how really older programs and older brands react and adapt to things like social media. And my name is Vijay Ranganathan. I work with the Institute of International Education, and I've worked with the Fulbright program, or an aspect of it, for a few years now. But I'm going to put that hat aside and really focus on the other aspect of my passion and also my work, which is social media and digital strategy. And so I'm going to be moderating our panel, and we're going to have Megan, Katie, and Doug talk about the Fulbright program and kind of answer a lot of my questions and any of your questions as well. So that's what's happening here. And we really want to get at the heart of the question that we have on the table today, which is this panel crazy? No. I'm sure many of you are thinking, like, is this crazy link bait kind of panel title? Why is Fulbright jumping on the bandwagon? You know, Fulbright's a mid-20th century thing, and they're kind of just latching on to this whole idea of social media. And while I understand that kind of idea, I disagree. And there's a reason why. There are a few core ideas that are relevant to Fulbright, person-to-person, borderless, etc. And I was realizing when I, as a social media professional, was thinking about it, that those core ideas also are core to social media, including that last one, making the world a better place. You know, in the Facebook IPO, Mark Zuckerberg talked about how he wants to make the world a better place and how that's an important core idea of Facebook. Obviously, he said this in the Facebook IPO filing anyway. So, I mean, he does want to make money, but there is a, you know, maybe we're approaching it from different angles, this idea of making the world a better place. Fulbright more explicitly about, you know, bringing about peace. This is my argument for, yes, Fulbright is a social medium. It's just not a digital social medium. Feel free to disagree, and, you know, when we get to questions and answers, which we'll have lots of time for discussion, I'd love to hear your opinions as well. So anyway, the real core questions that we're... Oh, yeah, I forgot. This is the big difference here. The reason why we call ourselves, or we call Fulbright, the first social network. It started about 55 years before social media was an idea, and that's a big thing to us, and we think it's the first, and if anyone can think of something that's older, we'll get to them later. So anyway, we have a couple core questions, which have to do with old brands and in the world of the new media and the brave new world. First, how do old brands adapt? I mean, how do we make sure we're relevant? How do we make sure we don't fail, or worse, hit icebergs and sink? And that's something that is something we all want to avoid if we represent older brands that are trying to adapt to this. And second, something that's more core to the design of Fulbright, what role does international exchange have? I mean, a lot of us participated in the Arab Spring or Jasmine Revolution, whichever you call it, from our own homes here in the U.S., and we didn't actually leave our apartments or our offices to go and participate. And at the same time, we were participating in something happening thousands of miles away. So those are the questions that I'm going to keep coming back to. I also have a bunch of other questions for our panelists. But at this point, I'm going to pass it off to Megan Neff. Megan, if you can introduce yourself and get started.
Sure. Well, like you said, my name is Meg Neff, and I'm here as a contractor representing the U.S. Department of State, Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs. My office is the Office of Academic Exchanges, and we are responsible for managing the Fulbright program, among other things. Personally, I'm responsible for managing the digital assets. Hello. Personally, I'm responsible for handling the digital assets of the Fulbright program, such as social media and web. And just show of hands, is anyone in here a Fulbrighter, former Fulbrighter? Yes? Okay. For anyone who might not be familiar, the Fulbright program is just very quick overview. It's a scholarship program that allows U.S. Students and researchers to go overseas in order to study and research, and non-U.S. students and researchers to come into the U.S. to study and research. So currently we serve over 150 countries, and it is considered one of the most prestigious scholarships available. We serve about 5,700 students and 2,100 scholars annually. And among our distinguished alumni, we have 43 Nobel Prize winners, 78 Pulitzer Prize winners, 28 MacArthur Foundation awardees, and 16 awardees of the U.S. Presidential Medal of Freedom. Most recently, we've had two of our filmmakers nominated for Academy Awards for their short documentaries. We had Rebecca Camisa and Lucy Walker. Unfortunately, neither of them won this year, but there's always next year, and we're hoping. And actually for Rebecca, I think it's her second one, isn't it?
Yeah, it's her second nomination.
So, and actually she was supposed to be joining us on this panel today, but then she found out she was nominated, so she had other engagements, unfortunately. And just to go back to a little bit of background on the Fulbright program, the program, as you mentioned earlier, was founded in 1946. It came out of the, let's call it, chaos and destruction of World War II. Senator Fulbright basically proposed this program as a way to increase mutual understanding through people-to-people exchanges, which to us on the day-to-day, we basically translate this to finding a way for people to learn about other cultures and share their own cultures with others in the hopes of understanding people from different places and different backgrounds. And he did this in order to try and help the world avoid another catastrophic war. So it was signed into law August 1st, 1946 by President Truman. And this is really a very important point because it does kind of get to the crux of the panel. The Fulbright program goes back to 1946, which means we have alumni of the program spanning decades. So how do you take an old, established brand like that into the modern era of technology and education? And do you even need to? Obviously, the Fulbright program existed long before there was social media or the internet. Is there even a point to trying taking it into the new world? And we have a panel here at South by Southwest, so I think it's pretty obvious that we believe that answer to be yes, otherwise we probably wouldn't be here. And the reason for that, at least for me, is that while this is a historical program, it's not a stagnant program. We do change, we do update, we do have new programs come to keep up with the times. As Katie will go through, we have something called the Fulbright MTVU program, which obviously didn't exist in 1946. But at its core, it's about people-to-people connections. 70 years ago, those connections were formed with a handshake and were kept up with letters and maybe an occasional phone call. Nowadays, people, you know, staying in contact is a matter of staying in constant contact. It's emails, it's web, it's chat. And the mission for the Fulbright program hasn't changed. We want to create these lasting ties and connections, and in the 21st century, social media is the way to do that. So as an education slash government slash public diplomacy entity, which exists across many countries and cultures and has many participants and organizations, how do we function in the realm of social media, particularly in the scope of a government institution? I don't know, is anyone here from government? No? Oh, it's very fortunate because I guess I'm the only one then. Well, then I'll just give you a little tidbit about trying to work in social media and government. It's very hard sometimes. Social media moves very fast, and governments can move very, very slow. but what we found in order to try and bring, in this case, the Fulbright program brand into the 21st century, is we found two major points. The first is not controlling the brand. And what I mean by that is, if you look at our lovely slide here, these are all Fulbright brands. Some of them are official brands that come from U.S. embassies, Fulbright commissions, co-ops, alumni organizations, you name it. Some of these are unofficial organizations. They're organizations that were just started by people who participated in the Fulbright program and wanted to do something under the umbrella of Fulbright. Either way, we can't go around to all of these people and say, hey, stop posting that, or hey, use this picture, or hey, we want you to do this. We can't do that. It's not feasible, and we wouldn't want to try to. So if you ever go on Facebook and, you know, you're just searching around and you decide to search for the Fulbright program, you will find hundreds of hits. And we can't try to control all of those. What we do try to do is we try to serve as the official spokesperson, the official place for anyone looking for Fulbright information to go. In the case of Facebook, what we did when we started our Facebook page, we started connecting with communities around official institutions, whether they're educational institutions or U.S. embassies. And eventually people started looking and saying, oh, hey, this Fulbright program is affiliated with all of these real institutions that I'm involved in. This must be the real thing. And at that point, we were finally able to start communicating with the people and building the community around the actual Fulbright brand. The other thing I wanted to touch on very quickly, I'm sure I'm running low on time already. The other thing I want to touch on very quickly is the fact that we have a hugely diverse audience. We not only have an audience of current and prospective Fulbrighters who are typically younger people, who are typically more wired in and who are more interested in social media, we also have those people who participated in this program 50 years ago, who may not necessarily care about Facebook or who may not necessarily care about, you know, having these videos available on YouTube or whatever else. So we're constantly looking for ways to reach out to all of these different communities. And for anyone who works in social media, go where your audience is or who's your audience are probably things that come up on a daily basis. It's no different for the Fulbright program brand. I'll use Google Plus as a quick example. We started our Google Plus page this year, actually in January, and we did that because we saw two distinct audiences rising up. We saw a community rising up around educational institutions, and we saw a community rising up around young tech professionals. And we're like, hey, this is great. These are two communities that we really want to get in touch with. And so we're trying to go there and trying to reach out to these communities. LinkedIn audience, again, works very the same way. Young and mid-level professionals looking to reach out. And then the final one that I do want to touch on is our bloggers audience, which for me is very interesting because I enjoy blogging a great deal, not just for myself, but just as a concept, because it takes old world storytelling and merges it with new technology. And this is something that we found to be very beneficial for the Fulbright program because many people who are involved in Fulbright have these great long stories to tell, and blogging is a great way for them to do it, especially from the field. And actually, at that point, I'm going to hand it off to talk more about blogging because Katie actually has a great deal of experience in blogging in the field, don't you?
Yeah, a bit. I went to Mexico a couple years ago in 2008 as a Fulbright MTVU fellow, and this is a new program that the Fulbright program started. It's a public-private partnership with MTVU. The basic idea is to use music as a force for promoting international understanding. So grantees go through the traditional Fulbright application process, but they design projects that focus on some issue of international music culture. And the expectation is that once students get abroad, they will blog constantly about what they see and what they experience, and they'll share a lot of digital material about the musical communities that they're in. So the goal is to kind of expand Fulbright's message through this partnership, through online channels, and with a topic that global audiences can easily tap into. One of the great strengths, I think, of this program in the 21st century is that it asks grantees to engage both academically and as media producers. In my case, that meant merging my experiences in anthropology with audio production. And so grantees need to be able to both get a nuanced view of the culture that they're in as researchers, but they also need to be able to speak about it in compelling ways. But that also turned out to be one of the greatest challenges I found of this program, speaking as a representative of the State Department and IIE, but also speaking as a representative of MTVU sometimes led to some interesting, you know, tensions. Can you go to the next slide? So the aim of my project was to highlight Mexico's cultural diversity through an exploration of its traditional musics, plural, and through the lens of urban youth revivals in particular. My product was, in addition to blog entries, I also made these audio slideshows that we called audio flipbooks, where I focused on a specific Mexican musician or, you know, young person who was learning music in a different Mexican style. My broader goal was to kind of participate in what we're calling digital diplomacy. I wanted to construct a media narrative about Mexico that focused on its cultural wealth, its strong communities, as a way to sort of provide an alternative to dominant media narratives about Mexico as a developing or a drug trafficking or a dangerous place. So lots of my Fulbright work wound up taking place in media space. You know, I spent about half my day in music lessons with students at the School of Mexican Music in Mexico City, and then the other half of my day managing all the digital content that I made through those encounters, you know, editing photos, editing audio, drafting blog posts. So the fact that I was so connected while I was abroad made me reflect more about the value of why I was there physically in the first place. I had to ask myself what the purpose was of me being there if my work was ultimately geared towards an online audience and an English-speaking one at that. I knew I wasn't a journalist. I wasn't really a travel writer, although sometimes I tried to tap into those kind of roles. I was first and foremost a cultural ambassador, this role of the Fulbrighter. And that's this very vague and weighty term that is kind of up to the individual grantee to figure out. And for me, I found that the best way to continue being a cultural ambassador was to just make sure I was constantly showing up for things. There's an impulse to kind of hide behind your device and, you know, try to tap into Mexican culture through the abundance of media that was available to me online. But I had to remind myself that the number one goal was to get myself to class every day, get myself in the community, and just spend time together. Can you go to the next slide? If you've lived abroad, I think you know how important this is, that so much of what makes travel meaningful is just the serendipity of things that you find and the people that you meet. Like I said, I think it's a little bit too easy to sort of just take comfort in our devices and maybe focus too much on recording our kind of exotic experiences that we have abroad, gear them towards our own personal and professional networks, and to not really be present or engage with the community that we've traveled so far to learn about and to build ties with. So this program really reminded me that being there and being present was key to showing people that I was interested in this culture and invested in learning about it in a respectful way. I think it's one thing to show your interest in a culture through retweeting or through some kind of mediated interaction, but the stakes are completely different when you're stammering, you know, or trying to show commitment to learning the language of your host country, or you're asking to learn a song. So really that investment in time, I think, is important. So while we can't really replace these things with mediated interactions, I think that once we do put in time, it makes the right conditions for great media, for great respectful and engaging media that can benefit both audiences at home and the audiences in your host community. So that's sort of the traditional aspect of the Fulbright program that I think is still really key, is making sure that grantees go abroad and for an extended period of time where they still have a lot of time to follow their nose on the ground, figure out what communities they can engage with and what those communities' media needs are that they can help serve. So if you want to go to the next one, this is just a country music camp that I went to, that was completely unplanned in my project proposal, but I learned about it through my contacts in Mexico. I would have never learned, for example, that, the Chicano community in the United States is really key in keeping traditional Mexican music alive. This is at a Son Jarocho festival in Veracruz. Would have never learned that through Googling. It was only through contacts and tips on the ground that I got exposed to this really vibrant community, and that led to one of the strongest posts that I and audio slideshows that I made while I was abroad. So sort of my ultimate question, I guess, if you want to go to the last slide, AJ, is this question of digital diplomacy. And, you know, I'm really interested in whether this blog is a good model for capturing the Fulbright experience and rendering it in a way that not just American audiences, but also local and international audiences can benefit from. I think that the blog has a long way to go, but there's some definite signs of progress in the 5 years that this program has been around. First, grantees are blogging a lot more frequently than they initially did. So there's just a richer representation of the cultures that people are in that's being produced on this blog. The design of the site is vastly improved from the first year, so there's more space for people to leave feedback, and you can kind of switch between grantees who are really in all corners of the world very easily. Also, I've noticed there's a change in the blogging style. You can really see the transition from the old model of the Fulbright to the new through the way that bloggers blog. At the beginning, it was very kind of academic and sort of official and kind of safe, and now I think bloggers are letting their personality shine through a little bit more. There's a little more sarcasm and humor. It's punchier and it's shorter, and I think it's important to manage length too when we make, you know, media that we want people to be able to digest easily. In my own blog, I noticed a real sort of transition over the course of the year from getting comments from my own personal social network for the first few posts, lots of comments from mom, by the end of the year, I was getting a lot of feedback from interested strangers, you know, and I did that through cross-media and cross-platform promotion, using my social networks, dipping into into other people's blogs and leaving comments and trying to drive traffic to the site. And this is something that that IIE and the State Department, I think, is doing a terrific job of. There's, I think, thanks a lot to Vijay, there's a lot of tweets and a lot of things that direct grantees to opportunities and direct them to this blog and similar other grantees' blogs to really keep the conversation going online. But I still think that that piece of having people there on the ground is always going to be key.
Right. So I think I'll back up a little bit. And I think one of the reasons I was able to get on this panel is because of a tweet I saw last year. I was here wandering around, and I saw it. I follow the Fulbright program, and I'll get to the Fulbright I did. And I follow Jamie Lawrence. And he tweeted out that if you're a Fulbrighter and you're at South by Southwest Interactive and you want a T-shirt, come by our booth. And we're all down with the swag, right?
Hey, Doug, can I interrupt for a sec?
Oh, sure.
Did anyone in the audience also see that tweet? Well, was anyone here last year? And yeah, so we had one person. Okay.
Okay. Did you get a T-shirt? Okay, well,
he did not get a T-shirt.
But there will be T-shirts again this year, so do keep your eyes open.
So anyway, I saw the tweet, and I went over to the booth, and I said, "Hi, I'm Doug Mitchell. I did a Fulbright in 2007, and I saw your tweet." And Jamie just, his eyebrows went up. Wow, somebody saw it. So, and he gave me a T-shirt. So, and then of course, he had to put me to work. So I stayed in touch with Jamie over the year, and then BJ pitched a panel, and I said I was going to be here anyway, and so that's how I ended up here. So I'm going to back up even further and say my dad said a couple of things to me he said more than a couple of things over to me over the years. But when I was younger, he would say, I would go out, hang out with my friends and come back, and he would say something like, "Ah, the prodigal son returns," which means I was never home. I was always out somewhere and always came back, usually at dinner time. I would always go out and come back. And it took me many, many years to figure out what he actually meant. And then I figured out that I have this thing about going places, whether it was down the street to my friend's house or at 17 going to Mexico because I could. I traveled to many. I worked at NPR for almost 22 years. I was a producer. I worked with all those. If you're a listener, I worked with all those people, going to 45 states, several different countries, producing stories. I'm a radio guy. And my dad still says, "Ah, the prodigal son returns." So go to the next slide.
Yep.
So while at NPR, and I didn't have enough to do, it's a non-for-profit thing, you know, it's like, oh yeah, I can do more stuff. after 10 years of being there, I noticed that there was no pipeline for young people to come into public radio. So I decided to go out and create one, in addition to the job I was already doing. So in 1999... I did my hand in the, I don't know if y'all remember the startup, y'all. God, I'm in Texas for 3 days and I'm saying y'all.
It's okay. You're from Oklahoma. It's fine.
And I'm from Oklahoma. I got rid of it though. I tried a startup in 1999. We lasted about 9 months, spent too much of my own money and got out. But I thought there's a lot of stuff that I learned. So let me apply that to where I work, which is currently a branded company called NPR. And, I went on, Yahoo Domains and found next generation radio was not being used. So I immediately started cyber squatting on that. .net, .org, I think those were the only ones really available at that time. But it created a program in which younger people in college who were interested in working in public radio could have a pipeline to get in. So what we did was created an internal program called Intern Edition. And the external program was called Next Generation Radio. And we'd go to minority journalism conferences. I'd go to the college media conference every year. We had a boot camp where 5 students would apply to get in. And I'd pair them up with a mentor. Again, my dad told me years ago that the best student-teacher ratio was 1-to-1. And so I decided 5-on-5 was good. It's a basketball thing also. I like basketball. And so there was five students, 5 mentors, myself, and an editor. And we would be essentially a traveling roadshow. There were at our peak, we did 8 or 9 boot camps in 8 or 9 cities with 8 or 9 different teams of people. And I learned project management at that time, too. But the advantage was, and you can see in this one slide, that we did come here to Austin. And so this is like my 8th South by Southwest. I'm a veteran. I know where to go drink.
We're talking about Fulbright here. Come on.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry.
We're serious.
We don't do that.
We're very serious here.
You can tell by the way we're all dressed. So it was... it was really a great thing because at the time there wasn't a thing called social networking. We didn't really use the word networking. But at the time, I was building out a personal network of people who started out in college, then moved on, and then became professionals. And I made connections with people and found at our stations and our network that there were people who may not be directly involved, and one of them sitting over here on the floor, George Lara, WBEZ, the people who also felt and philosophically were aligned with the way I was thinking. And we would also say to each other, if I can help you out, let me know. So if you want to move to the next one. Our intern edition program, I found people inside the building who couldn't say anything, but said, if I can help you out, let me know. So the interns, three times a year, would, you know, a collection of 40 overachievers would come and sit around a table at the very beginning editorial meeting, and I would say, this is yours. Do something with it. Well, so what are the rules? And I said, well, if there's a problem, they'll yell at me, but I'll be the person standing in between. So go do what you need to do. I'll give you some tips. Here's a training guide. Here's who not to talk to. And then have at it. And so this was one of the last intern editions that we did. And this is their work. This is all that they did. If you give people room to do things, it's amazing what they can do. And my job was to basically just run interference. If you can go to the next slide, too. So I'll get to the fellowships I've done. I've done three. The first one was the Knight International Press Fellowship to Chile in 1997. And like anything, I always try to do the best job I possibly can because then they turn around and say, can you come back? It's like note to self. Make sure you do the best job you possibly can. Keep your mouth shut and listen, which is what I did. And they invited me to come back. And I went back in 2003. In 2003, the young lady at the top, Marie Paz Amorcilla, was my assistant when I was there. I was there for 3 weeks on a U.S. State Department visiting visiting professor, USAID, had a title of about that long, program. And she was my assistant when I was there, and I was really impressed with her. And I said, you know what, let me give back. So let me see about getting her from Chile to come to NPR. And we worked it out, and she spent the summer of 2004 at NPR. We trained her how to do news spots, which are essentially 30 to 45, 50-second news stories that would be embedded inside the newscasts. So she went back to Santiago. She bought all her equipment. She got all the training, and she went back to Santiago and for 2.5, 3 years filed stories from Santiago for NPR. So we basically developed a correspondent to be down, because there was nobody covering that that part of the world at the time, and I think there still isn't, which is a whole other story. Go to the next slide, please. So then in 2006, I saw that the Fulbright program, I had applied once, and I was one of those who applied and didn't get in. And I was really, you know, it was really disappointing. I was ready to take a year off and go on some swashbuckling excursion someplace, because I've already done two fellowships. But I'm sort of joking. I've actually figured out that in my time in the two fellowships I did, that I had a value add to the place I was going. So in 1997, I went to university in Santiago, went to the same university in 2003, and then applied to go back again to the same place under the Fulbright program in 2007, and I got accepted. The one I got accepted into was called the Senior Specialist Program. It's for people who are working professionals who cannot go away for 9, 10 months, spend a year, working professionals who could just slip away for a few weeks. It was 6 weeks. I stayed for 7, paid my own way to stay for a 7th week. And then spent time working with students. Go to the next slide, if you will. Working with students in their studio there at Católica. They had built out a radio studio in the time between 2003 and 2007. The great thing about the development of social networking is now all my friends down there, I feel like I talk to them every day. The fact that I put a personal stamp on it first by showing up, being there, being available, having an office, students would come talk to me just like I did at NPR. Meant that they would invite me to come back. And so I went back. If we go to the next one, too. And while there, this is I call this our international relations meeting. We're actually having lunch. So the guy on the left, his name is Dan Brewington. I think he and I were the only two African-American men in Chile. It was a joke. Because I saw what he looked like, and he saw what I looked like, and I said, we have to talk. So at the time, he was running Santiago Radio, which was an online radio station. He was partnered with a guy who ran a newspaper, an online newspaper, online-only newspaper. They had a falling out. Dan got motivated. If you go to the next slide. Started up. Go to the next one after that. Oh. Oops.
Did
Did I lose the slide?
Oh, no, that's okay. He started up a place called ilovechile.com. And I probably just didn't give you the screen grab for it. He got motivated to start up a company. And at the time that I started getting interested in startups and entrepreneurship and et cetera, he started up his company, and I'm an unofficial board member of his now. At the school in the time from 2007, started Radio UC, which is radiouc.cl. That's their online radio station that the students run. That was my Fulbright in 2007. I went there to help them launch this company. So I know I'm probably running out of time. So all that is to say that I've done three fellowships. I was able to tie them between the work I did at NPR and add value to the work that they wanted to do at this university, the journalism school at the University in Santiago, launched a radio station, helped a guy launch an English language company in Santiago, and to pay it forward, I'm now looking at writing a proposal to go back to Chile to work inside and embed myself inside the internet radio station and company that Dan Brewington is running. And the school is interested in developing entrepreneurship curriculum for startup companies in Chile.
Cool. Thank you. Thank you all, actually. I have been taking a few notes, and I feel like the three of you reflect like this three-sided coin, if one existed, of sort of Fulbright and social media. We have like sort of official Fulbright communication to the world. Then we kind of have in the middle Katie, who's sort of unofficial, semi-connected, but also still representing herself to the world. And then we have Doug, who's kind of from the world back into Fulbright. And I feel like the three of you reflect sort of all the different flavors of social media that I can think of with Fulbright. But right now, my main question is, and I think it's for all of you, so whoever wants to take it first, is how did the fact that, Doug, I think this is more for you, I think, since you went to Chile and there wasn't social media then, how does the fact that you are now connected with them full time affect the way that you think about your future projects in a Fulbright or overseas or anything, even here?
I think it affects it only in that, and I made reference to that, is I feel like I talk to them every day. We're on Twitter, they have set up Facebook pages, there's an online radio station, I can listen to it anytime I want. But I think the value is that I went there physically, went there, sat in an office, talked to people on a daily basis. This was at the advent of social media.
Right.
It was easy to be early, we're all early adopters, so when it first came along, I didn't have to get dragged kicking and screaming into it. We had to drag some professors into it, certainly, and it was certainly it's an academic environment. But I think the advantage sometimes you just have to get lucky too. I ended up going to a place where many of the faculty at the journalism school had done their graduate work in other countries, and they do it on purpose. They purposely send people to other countries to learn. My best friend down there, Sergio Godoy, did his in the UK.
So okay. He
talks to me as a Brit, even though he's not from there. It's very funny, actually. So the advantage was that I went there, physically made the relationships first, and now we have all this technology where we stay together.
Okay. Right. And actually, I think we have a couple Fulbrighters in the audience. Is that right? We have a couple? So do either of you want to go to the mic and just talk about what you did and why you decided to come to this? You want to go first? And the reason why I want this is because I want to get a sense of the full flavor of Fulbright. Yeah, go ahead. Tell us.
Probably don't need
mic.
I'm loud.
For the podcast. I'm loud, too.
Oh, it's a podcast.
Yeah, they're recording it.
Let's see. Here we go. Is that good? All right. So my name is Prejwal Sirium, and I was... Oh yeah, the back of my thing is because I want people to come up and talk. Everyone's always on their phone all the time. Yeah.
He's got a sign on his back for those people who are listening.
So I was a Fulbrighter in the UK with Alex Hudson and Michael Trice and lots of other really cool people. And probably the best thing that I'm here because I think we saw the title of the panel. and it perfectly captured what the dynamic and relationship we had with Fulbright and with the rest of Fulbrighters were. Well, really, the thing that we got out of the Fulbright program more than anything else is that the three of us ended up starting a company right after after our Fulbright experience.
What was your Fulbright, and what was the experience?
That's funny.
What's the
company?
Okay, well, so I was doing systems biology at Cambridge. This guy was doing theoretical chemistry, and Michael was doing something that was actually sort of related to our company. and so we ended up, and so the company is everyone, he had a great panel today, and I finally learned what he did on his book right here.
He'll come up next.
The startup, which is called Partisans, is a political media startup that's bringing together thoughtful commentary from across the political spectrum, trying to parse all of the different kinds of opinions on the political web. It's, to my thinking, is the sort of thing that Fulbright in really makes you think about, right? So you bring this group of people together who have so many different viewpoints and perspectives, and you put them in at least the few times a year that everyone gets together across the country in the same space to connect, to talk, to disagree, to argue, to fight. And we felt, good kind of fighting, we felt
of course,
like that was something that needed to be scaled and extended, that people are coming in from around the world, Fulbright, other sorts of networks, and how can we use that to make political discourse better and more interesting, richer? And we couldn't have done it if Fulbright hadn't served that kind of really deep, rich social network.
So you're getting to something that you tweeted just at the beginning of our panel, which was that you feel there is a distinction between the deep, as you say, Fulbright experience and the transient social media experience. And I want to take that question back to Meg and Katie and Doug. And I want to know, what do you think? Do you think that there is an experience that is very transient on the social networks where really you don't get that depth? I mean, Katie, you actually have a great experience having sort of been in the middle of kind of both.
Just to sort of speak to what you were saying, though, too, in terms of where the impact comes from this gathering of people, I thought about that a lot, too, because I did find myself investing a lot in my Fulbright network in Mexico City, in addition to my local network of Mexican classmates. And I found that the payoff for that, I felt, was that when we go back into our respective diverse fields, we're going to infuse our work with not only our experience abroad, which I think is one aim of the program, but also our conversation with each other. And I really felt that needed to be played up. I think there's kind of a anxiety when you're traveling that you're not integrating enough, you're not integrating. And I don't think you should fight the fact, too, that you can have a really transformative and productive dialogue with other travelers as well. So I think a lot of
doing that online,
and so much of that is maintained online now. So that I think is one of the most fruitful aspects of the Fulbright program that we shouldn't want to hide. We should, you know, really embrace. But then, of course, I think it does come down to balance. So I think the task of the Fulbrighter today is going to be managing your immersion and your time with community engagement. That's a big criterion of the application process, is making sure that all grantees are upfront about how they're going to engage with their local community. So you need to have that piece, but you should also really take advantage of this once-in-a-lifetime experience to commune with people who are in this really, you know, kind of transformative moment of their lives and make something productive out of it, like you guys have.
And I'd also add that, again, I am the elder statesman here. I came up without a cell phone and all the technology, and so the art of conversation and the
art of
engagement.
So you were there before it was cool. You're the resident hipster.
my host down in Chile had arranged for me to go to various other parts of the country. To go to other universities to tell them about what was happening. And, you know, NPR was the lure. They had heard about public radio and the kind of journalism that we did, and they wanted exposure to it. And so that was the hook all three times. I managed to build it out because on the Fulbright, there was so much more technology available in 2007. When I first got there in 97, I could go online and watch USA Today slowly feed into the screen so I could follow the Chicago Bulls as their march to, you know, so. And then at the time I left, we were all, you know, I got one of those unlocked phones and could, you know, could talk to people via cell phone. So I still believe in the, you are a true ambassador. You know, I ended up in, you know, defending the United States too, much more than I ever thought I would. What's wrong with you people? Now, what do you mean, new people?
Is that true for our Fulbrighters in the audience and also you, Katie? Did you find that you were defending the U.S. more than you expected?
No, I found that people were just thrilled that I was there.
It must have been where I went.
That, I mean, the idea of a Michigan girl putting on a mariachi costume and being willing to sit through 5 days of strumming the chord progressions was just, I found, you know, people found that really delightful and at least as far as I could tell, and they were nothing but welcoming. So I didn't really have too much of a, I didn't have to really defend the United States that much.
All right, that's fair. And I want to feed off of something that you both said, which had to do with the immersiveness of being in the country. And I wanted to ask both of you about the fact that every day when you got back to your respective places where you lived, you could nowadays, you could just jump online. Katie, you did. You could jump online, get on Facebook, and feel like you're, you know, you could be anywhere at that moment. And it's no longer, like, placed in the culture. Now you've just removed yourself and you're back in that box. And I wonder, Meg, can public diplomacy and Fulbright be immersive when I can always, you know, like half the people in the room, go back to my device, and me with like four devices in front of me, go back to my device and be in the world that I create and not the world that is out there and, you know, created.
Oh, absolutely. And I think you talked a lot about this, about, first of all, trying to, when people are applying, letting them know that, listen, just because you're going down to study in a classroom that's in a different country doesn't mean that your entire experience should entail being in a classroom in a different country. And there's one little anecdotal story that I really love from a Fulbrighter. I think he went to somewhere in the Middle East and he was teaching. He was an English teaching assistant. And he was talking about how he was surprised that, you know, people are a lot more similar to himself and the people that he'd grown up around than he expected. And but then at the end, he had this little story where he'd been teaching a group of younger children. And he used an American children's book just to show them and go through everything with them. And the children's book featured a moose as the main character. And these kids lost it. That's not a real animal. That thing could never exist anywhere. How can you live having that tromping around your house at night? How do you sleep at night? They refused to believe that there was such thing as a moose. And he had to literally take a class time out of this and go through, yes, we have moose and we have all these other crazy animals. And that's something that never would have happened if this guy had just gone, taught his English, said, okay, you know, here we are, that's it, and then gone home and just decided that, okay, I'm going to exist within my own.
So he jumped online and said, you know, looked up Google images, moose, and said, look, is that what happened pretty much?
No, he actually, as I understand it, he went through and did like a whole lesson on the United States and the animals and the flora and the fauna and that sort of thing.
Right. But I'm still kind of concerned about the immersiveness of this experience when he goes home after that moment, you know, and he's like, okay, I'm going to make a lesson plan. But first, what's my friend doing? And goes on Facebook. And do you feel like you're removing yourself, Katie?
I think we kind of confront this question every day. We're confronting it here at South By, you know, how much time should I let myself spend scrolling through my phone and kind of tailoring my own experience right now? And
putting
how much
signs
I
on our backs.
Just, yeah, go out there and just see what life throws at me. I hope that people who self-select for a Fulbright experience are committed to, or, you know, recognize the value of travel, and it's just something you can't approximate with media, and know that it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and when you're there, you want to make sure that you're, you know, living it up and spending as much time out there talking to people as you can. But I also think that there's one way of inhabiting a different culture too, increasingly, is inhabiting social networks online. So, you know, we talked about different regionally specific social networks.
Right.
So I think there's a lot of, you know, potential for, you to do your work of cultural, of, you know, connecting to people culturally through, you know, through online social networks, but you need to be attentive to which ones they're using, like, you know, High Five, for example, really popular in Latin America.
And so, and maybe this is a question for you, Meg. Are, is Fulbright not engaging enough in that way from, like, the official Fulbright to the world in these social networks? Or, you know, do should we do more?
As
in,
far as...
in these local community, High Five, Ibibo, Orkut, if it's still being used in Brazil.
It's funny you should ask, because my first job at the State Department was actually going to every country and country and saying, what language are you speaking? Are you using that language online? What platforms are you using? And it is an extremely difficult question. Basically, what we've decided to do is we have become, like I was talking about earlier, we've become the source for the Fulbright information on the social networks that we've chosen, because those are the ones that we find people are using the most. We get the most reach with Facebook. But actually, the Google Plus example that I brought up earlier actually really touches on this. You guys had mentioned earlier about how you only get to meet other Fulbrighters every, you know, a couple times a year when you get together for these big conferences. And of course, you know, even though you guys are out of the program, the conferences continue and we still have a lot of interesting engagement going on at those. And in the past several years, the past several months, Google Plus. No one has mentioned Facebook anymore if they're a non-US citizen here studying. No one says, oh, I got on Facebook today. It's always, I got on Google Plus. And we see this as an amazing opportunity because we're seeing people from Latin America, we're seeing people from Asia, and they're like, oh, hey, I'm all on Google Plus. So we're taking advantage of it where it exists. Okay. But at the same time, you know, going on something like Kontakte or something like that, right. It's extremely narrow. And that's one of the reasons that we really encourage Fulbrighters to be cultural ambassadors as well. If you're a Fulbrighter in Russia and you speak Russian, go ahead, tell your Fulbright story on these platforms that, I mean, I don't speak Russian, I can't go there and I can't address these people, but you're a Fulbrighter, you know the program, you know your country, and you are learning about the culture that you're living in. Okay. Go forth and speak about that. Go forth and talk to people, even if it is just on a social network. If you're on a specialized social network, you know, learn more about those people and tell them more about yourself.
All right.
BJ, I have one other example I'd like to, and just this has happened in the last couple of weeks on LinkedIn. And that is, Fulbrighters in D.C. had a meetup on last Friday, and that hadn't happened before, because one person posted a question: I am a Fulbrighter from this whatever country it was. Is there anybody in any other Fulbrighters in D.C.? And then I chimed in, a few others chimed in, and unfortunately I was here. Well, fortunately or unfortunately, I was here. But there was a meetup that happened, and I was so thrilled to see that Fulbrighter, and D.C. is, you know, it's where everything, the government anyway, is there. People tend to come back to D.C., I think, from the economy standpoint. That's, you know, there's been still a lot of jobs there.
Right.
And I think for people who have been out and about and are now looking for each other. So through LinkedIn, there's now a Fulbright D.C. meetup group.
Okay. I mean, I feel like I've been asking a lot of questions. I know I referred to one of Praj's questions. Are there any questions from the audience? And feel free to just walk up to the mic and ask questions. If not, I have like this whole list right here that I could just burn through.
Oh, no.
But this is, I don't want to talk at, you know, I'd rather talk with. So please, come on up.
My question is for Megan. How are you keeping older alumni in contact with the brand? Do you find that there's a desire for that? Is there a concerted effort to do that? And are you seeing more of them come online, and what sort of social networks are they preferring?
Well, we are seeing more of them coming online, actually. One of the slides that I had earlier, I got a comment, I think, last month on our Facebook from someone who had been a Fulbrighter, I think it was like 20 or 30 years ago, and he comes on and he's like, this is amazing, I've been trying to find people forever, and I finally found this Facebook page, and I've been able to find people, thank you so much for doing it. So, of course, we enjoy seeing that a great deal. But it is few and far between, that sort of thing, because as, you know, time goes on, yes, we start seeing people coming on from the 80s and from the 70s, but from before that, you don't really see a lot of it. And unfortunately for that sort of thing, for the people who choose not to be engaged on social media, we still rely a great deal on our alumni associations. And, of course, we have alumni chapters that exist all over the country, all over the world, really, for those purposes. But at the same time, those alumni associations themselves are getting wired. They are getting more involved in social media, which is great, because then you have the Fulbright alumni who are younger and who are more excited about social media.
Pulling people along.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they're there, and they're involved with that. And then also then they go to the actual physical alumni associations and those meetups and that sort of thing. And then they start meeting some of these older, you know, less engaged alumni. And they're like, hey, you know, we were talking about this on the Facebook or on Twitter or that sort of thing. What do you guys think about this? So it still does trickle down that way.
I think if I may put my Fulbright hat back on for a second, this does go back to sort of going where the audience is kind of your question. And it does go back to the limitations of, you know, the standard limitations that everyone has, which is money. And you, with the lack of abundance of resources, you know, it's not abundant. So how do we find out where are these audiences when they're disparate and they're not pooling anywhere, you know? With Facebook, it's a nice big, you know, community pool. And you have everyone in these older groups who might not have these poolings and these places. I mean, Doug actually got on LinkedIn, and it's, you know, you're creating this little kiddie pool, and it's going to grow. And I mean, I feel like I'm just coming up with an analogy, but one of the difficulties is when you don't know where the audience is, how do you reach them? And I think that's something that Meg and I struggle with every day, actually. So it's funny that you should bring it
up. Things like this help, though. I think you've got to market yourself. You've got to, and you've got to be everywhere. You know,
right.
I've joined all these places. LinkedIn, I got on years ago when it first launched. You have to, and I think part of it's a thought that came to my head, and that is a certain kind of person does this sort of thing. I think, you know, through the application process, there's a whole weeding out. But
yeah, Katie had mentioned that.
Yeah, there's a certain kind of person who is willing to go wear the mariachi band. There's a certain kind of person who will. When I first got to Chile in '97, the first thing I did was go to the museums because I wanted to understand how people in Chile documented themselves. What do they say about themselves? How do they look at themselves? And so that way, when I sit around the university and we're having coffee and it's very academic, you know, we're like fingers in the air, you know, tuck and all of that, you know, I could understand what they were talking about. And, you know, this certain kind of person will do that. You won't get everybody, and right. I don't think you should.
And just that being said, you asked also about which social networks we are starting to see a rise on. Facebook, obviously, just because the older demographics are growing.
It's an ocean.
It's an ocean. But then also actually LinkedIn, simply because of the functionality of it, the type of person who isn't necessarily interested in social networks or for, you know, looking at the scone that their friend across the country just ate may very well be interested in going on LinkedIn, which has an entirely different purpose, obviously, which is networking. And, well, you guys do love to network.
Yeah, you have a question?
Yeah. So here we are at South by Southwest, which means we obviously all have an interest in digital interactives. And I imagine that there is an element, especially for Fulbright scholars who are going or have just gone, who deal with technology and...
That's such a great question.
And deal with technology within a cross-cultural, cross-national boundaries. So I'm really interested in, you know, that piece, but I'm also interested in what supportive roles there are or supportive spaces there are for Fulbright scholars who are dealing with technology, digital innovation, but sort of bringing the type of innovation that we've seen here today to the countries that you're visiting and sort of how-tos and sharing that sort of stuff.
Great, thank you. The question was, do I need to repeat it or no? Okay. I think you could all hear it anyway. This is just, you are such a good leading question for me because I really wanted Mike, who's in the audience, to talk about what he did, which is actually answers your question, both in the fact that what he did afterwards is about a lot of this, and also his project while he was in the UK was about technology. So, Mike, why don't you take it away?
Talk a little bit on the bus over here.
Can you mic yourself a little bit?
We'll talk afterwards, too. But there's a lot of potential in it. I guess I will just talk to the microphone.
Yeah, go for it. Or just grab it and turn around.
Yeah. How's this? There's a lot of room, I think, for that exact sort of outreach. And I think it's something that Fulbright is increasingly interested in. The project that I do technical communication research. So I was looking to work with nonprofit organizations in order to use social media to attempt to record oral traditions. And my primary interest was in what sort of literacies would need to be mapped and developed in order for that to be functional. And I worked with a nonprofit in Bristol in the United Kingdom, where the infrastructure, for the most part, is relatively well developed. But I worked in a very resource-poor community that just happened to have an exceptional, amazing nonprofit NGO that worked there, the Knoll West Media Center. And it was very fascinating learning how they accommodate. They've been doing media research and media activism essentially for 18 years, starting with photography and film, and then gradually building into digital engagement processes. And so and they have very democratic approaches, very grassroots. They go to the community and they ask the community what they want, and they give them as many options as they can. So it's not bringing a Facebook or, in my case, I was interested in developing a wiki for recording this information. But it's not just giving the community one option. It's finding out what the community is interested in doing and then giving them as many options as reasonably can be developed in order to sort of create these very high production projects. So they're not interested necessarily in just doing it and having the community feel good for doing it. It's really trying to create something of that would have lasting value anywhere and showing that any of these communities can do that. And I think that there's a strong place for being able to find out what works and what doesn't work in numerous different cultures. Of course, intercultural communication is a massive, massive issue, massive undertaking with the vast toolkit of technologies that exist, the different mechanisms, the different markets and networks that those technologies exist in, whether it is nonprofit or business, whether it's government. All of those have different issues. Not even getting into just standard global versus local issues. So there's so many different areas to look at and to work with. And my experience has been that the Fulbright's very, very interested in being able to support and take a look at those issues.
And Mike, did you feel like Fulbright as a program was not like oriented towards that type of project when you were applying? Did you think that, well, you know, I'm not doing your traditional academic research, I'm doing something kind of aside. Is Fulbright serving me? Did you have that question?
I thought that it would be unusual, but I was a little bit brazen and was hoping that that would give me an edge more than thinking that it was a drawback.
Yeah.
So maybe that was a little bit of blind optimism.
Well, but we're at South By. That's fine. Well, yeah. Irrational exuberance is the hashtag here.
Modus operandi is by Southwest. But yes, so the I think that there was some concern of whether it would fit in. A bigger concern for me was that, as a researcher, the field that I primarily work in is essentially restricted to the United States. It's growing a little bit in industry in India and China, but if I wanted to map it to a program abroad, then there was a real issue in having to work in a different field
right.
from the one that I was working at.
Does that answer your question? You had that second half, which I don't think we've really addressed.
Well, I mean, I just want to jump in here a second, just on behalf of the Fulbright program here. We do have a saying, at least in the D.C. office, I'm sure it trickles to other places, but this is we like to say that this is not your grandfather's Fulbright. And the reason that we like to say that is because we are trying to encourage more innovative, more technologically based programs. And just as a quick little anecdote, I mean, we've had a couple in the past years that have been really exciting. We had, for instance, I think one young woman who went to somewhere in Southeast Asia to do the effect of LED screens on advertising and how that, and then she came back to the United States and started working in that. We had another young woman who went out to Malaysia and she was studying, I think it was a business, and she, part of her program was immersing herself in the culture, and she realized, wow, you know, it's really difficult for workers in this part of the world, and she started a company called, I think it's like Conscientious Clothing and that sort of thing,
yep.
where it now operates out of Malaysia. We have a gentleman who went to Israel.
2 minutes.
Okay, so we had a gentleman who went to Israel who is working on a device which will detect certain types of cancer by smell. So we're really trying to encourage things like this because, again, we're trying to get the word out that, yes, we are still Fulbright and we still support traditional Fulbright initiatives, but, again, it's not your grandfather's Fulbright anymore.
And you had that second half of your question. Was that answered?
Well, yeah. You know, it's sort of blown my mind here at South by Southwest because
I'm gonna go to Finland for my Fulbright starting in August.
Congratulations.
Congratulations. Wow, nice.
I'm really excited. I just found out last week. My whole project is entirely helping them build their first national digital map initiative.
Nice.
So the things that I've learned here have really been inspiring, but I'm also thinking about this transference of knowledge piece, which is how can I be a representative not just of my country, but of the types of innovation that we're getting to see here that I know that chances are they're not getting to see in Helsinki, and I want to be that sort of vector. So that's also what I'm thinking about too, is how I can best do that.
And just, I know we are running out of time, but just real quick, I mentioned in 97 I was there as the ambassador to all of public radio in the United States, and I feel I remember what that was like, which is why I went to the museums. You know, I thought, let me go find out about them first. Where is it? I know about, I can teach. I had a background in teaching, as I mentioned, while working at NPR. But I think I was able to go in and say, I'm going to give you some knowledge, but I'm going to take something away from it as well. Let me go find out about you. Let me listen to a lot of where you are, have an understanding of where your media is in 1997, and then talk about storytelling. This, because it's all the same. It doesn't matter whether you're using a clip-on lapel or a handheld microphone, or you're now doing audio slideshows, and you still have to tell a narrative story. And
so,
I think by bringing it down there, that helped a lot.
I'm sorry, I have to cut you off.
That's fine. It's fine. You need to cut me off.
All right, you're an academic who also works for NPR. That's a double whammy, isn't it? I'm going back to our core two questions, and then we can continue this conversation not officially, because I know we're on a timeline. So our two core questions were, how do old brands adapt, and is there still value in international exchange in the brave new world of social media? And I got three answers to these two questions total. So Meg was saying, essentially, in answer to the brand question, you just need to go there and live with the fact that you can't control your brand. Is that a fair estimation? And then as long as you're there, people can come to you. And that was my understanding of what she said. I think that's something everyone says at South by every year, so that's nothing new. But it's good to reiterate, and it's good to know that the Fulbright program is acknowledging that. And then in answer to the second question about the relevance and the value of Fulbright, the answers I got from Katie and Doug were, from Katie, it's that social media actually deepens the experience rather than being that transient kind of surface-level interaction. It deepens it. And Doug actually followed up that with saying, you also are connecting with Fulbrighters and alumni, something that I think, I mean, as much as we've tried and as much as the Alumni Association has tried, we've always found that Fulbrighters connecting with each other has been something we want more of. And both of you are saying it actually creates a depth that you don't have before.
Right.
I still feel like there's an open question we can keep discussing about going back to the room and balancing, you know, Facebook time versus project time and going out into the streets, you know. So, but I like this conversation, and I want to keep having it. So thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you, Meg,
thank you.
Katie,
yeah,
Doug.
No problem.
And also to our Fulbrighters and would-be Fulbrighters in the audience.
Fulbrighters.
Thank you. So, thanks.